The Care Matters podcast is brought to you by the ESRC Centre for Care and CIRCLE, the Centre for International Research on Care, Labour and Equalities. In this series, our researchers welcome experts in the field and those giving or receiving care to discuss crucial issues in social care as we collectively attempt to make a positive difference to how care is experienced and provided.
Hello and welcome to Care Matters, the podcast from the Economic and Social Research Council Centre for Care and the University of Sheffield CIRCLE Research Centre. My name is Duncan Fisher and I am a Research Associate at the Centre for Care. We are delighted to welcome three esteemed guests to Care Matters, Nancy Falbrough, Naomi Lightman and Shireen Hussain. In this episode, we will discuss the devaluation and underpayment of care work, drawing on experiences from the USA, Canada, and the UK, we consider the challenges of assigning value to care, emphasising its social, cultural, and intergenerational dimensions. I will now introduce our guests. Nancy Falbrough is Professor Emerita of Economics and Director of the Programme on Gender and Care Work at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and a senior fellow of the Levy Economics Institute at Bard College in the United States. Her research explores the interface between political economy and feminist theory, with a particular emphasis on the value of unpaid care work. You can learn more about her at her website and blog, Care Talk. Naomi Lightman is an associate professor of sociology at Toronto Metropolitan University. Her areas of research expertise include care work, migration, gender, and critical research methodology. Shireen Hussain is Professor of Health and Social Care Policy at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and leads the Care Workforce Change Research Group in the Centre for Care. She is an established multidisciplinary research leader with extensive social care and health research experience, working primarily with policymakers in the UK and internationally. Welcome to Care Matters, Nancy, Naomi, and Shireen.
So when we talk about care, we can often say that it's devalued or underpaid. So what does it mean when we say that care is devalued or underpaid? Maybe Nancy, we could come to you first to think about this question.
Well, one big thing that comes to mind is that care is devalued because it's hard to make a profit on it, because care by definition is an effort to meet people's needs, not necessarily to just take advantage of their purchasing power. But another factor is that care has big multiplier effects. That is, if you care for someone, they're more likely to care for someone else, et cetera, et cetera. So what that means is it's really important to the economy and to the larger social climate, but it's very hard to capture the value that's created. The value that's created is very diffuse. It's very, you know, it sort of escapes the money metric. And so it's not going to be valued in money terms as much as it should be.
And Naomi.
And I think what's striking about care is, you know, we all rely on care at some point in our lives, but it is work that was traditionally done for free by women in private homes. And I think that is part of that relationship where we just don't value it the same as other types of jobs.
And Shireen.
Really, what's interesting for me that the care economy itself, so the care is one of those big growing sector where you can invest. And the care is sold in a very expensive way through a consumer lens, but the care work itself is not valued. So it's very easy to find situations where care is quite expensive to buy. However, people who are providing care, particularly those, of course, who are providing unpaid care, but even though we're providing paid care, are less valued. And this is because an assumption, so of course it's difficult to put an economic value on the product, but also an assumption that this comes naturally to people and people can do it easily. So there is a question as well about structures and employment and qualifications and career path and the divergence between care as a product and a consumer kind of targeted product is different from care being valued as a type of work.
Yeah, another way to put that in kind of the language that economists use is that care workers have very little bargaining power. And that problem is really compounded because often their clients don't have much bargaining power either or not much political voice. So both workers and consumers of care services are in kind of a weak position in the overall economy.
Yeah, and I mean, I think what Nancy's saying, of course, is that it's overwhelmingly women and immigrants and people of color that are doing these care work jobs. So they are people that have weak bargaining power and are just generally more vulnerable in society. And it's pretty striking how this is really consistent across countries, across continents, across welfare regimes in the global north and the global south. So it's really a universal phenomenon that we see.
Yeah, and I think that interestingly kind of comes back to your initial point, Nancy, about profit, because you know what Naomi says about the people who do the vast majority of the caring. We know this, we know who does it, but we also know that there are people who do profit from care, and you know who make money out of care as well, and that tends to be not the people who are doing the work on the ground, you know. So actually, in the UK, we know that there are corporations who make quite a lot of money out of it.
Yes, that's very true. But often, and this is especially the case in the US, their ability to turn a profit is very much based on public subsidies, taking advantage of public infrastructure. So it's a kind of collaboration or you know, concentration of economic power between the market and the state that allows a lot of profit to be made. I mean, in both the US and the UK, the healthcare system is heavily subsidized by the public sector, but a lot of the add-on services have been taken over by private firms and private equity and often really exploiting the structure of public support. So I don't know, one really shocking example recently in the US was private equity firms moving into hospice care, which is care for people who will be dying within a very short period of time. And the way in which the public subsidy was set up made it very, very easy to defraud the system and just garner huge profits without providing any services at all in hospice care.
And also, just given that the human input is a very important input in the provision of the care. So once you move out of care homes, which the structure, the infrastructure is one of the big investment, the profits margin can only come from the human input, because the human input and interface is the care, is a provision of care. So there is kind of a fundamental kind of tension between making profit and valuing the care work, because the margins comes from the wages of the care workers. And back to Naomi's point, where the majority of those who provide care are women with multiple responsibilities. So we know that a lot of women working formally in care have informal care responsibility. We know that women migrants, we know that people from ethnic minorities and from communities where there is a lot of inequalities. So then these are people who do not have the bargaining power, like Naomi said. And what another issue is interesting is what motivate people to work here. And this is a kind of paradoxical situation. So people come into care because they love doing care. They want to feel the reward from the people that they feel that they are helping others. And I think this point is exploited a lot through the system. So the system itself, kind of the structure, exploits this fact. So kind of, you know, we reward you in different ways, which is not wage related. We will acknowledge your work, like what we've seen during COVID, which is kind of, you know, clap to carers, but it didn't translate in the UK. It didn't translate to any wages or career progression. So there is this tension between having a business, care as a commodity, and care is reliant on the human input, and then kind of knowing the specific groups are attracted to work in care and their vulnerability, and systematically exploiting their characteristics and exploiting their motivations to work in that sector.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we certainly see this marketization of care that you're both talking about really globally. So increasing kind of profit motive in various sectors of the care economy. But we also have this huge care deficit where we don't have enough workers to do these jobs. And we have an entire, you know, we call it the global care chain, but it's an, you know, transnational global system where we import women from poorer countries or poorer parts of countries to come do jobs that typically native-born workers are not interested in doing, largely because of pay and working conditions. And not to take away from what Shireen was speaking about in terms of kind of the non-pecuniary benefits, so the real relationship between wanting to do better or help other people that motivates people to do these jobs, I also think we have entire immigration streams set up that kind of create incentives for migrants to come and do these jobs. So certainly in Canada, where I live and work, we have an entire immigration stream for live-in care workers. And what we see is that even within that, even as, you know, there's a policy understanding we need women to do these jobs, once they come, they're typically unable to do the jobs that they're trained for. And again, this is not just the case in Canada. They're overwhelmingly overqualified. We have many barriers for them to become permanent residents so they can actually stay in the country. They're overwhelmingly kind of transnational parenting, so they have families abroad that they would like to bring over, but there's many barriers to do so. So I think there's a lot of ethical issues in terms of the conditions that we create when we have people come over specifically to do these jobs. And that's even separate from the fact that this is very low wage, very physically demanding, mentally straining, complicated work. That, you know, as I'm sure we're going to talk more about, we really don't value.
Yeah, well, thanks, Naomi, for bringing the immigration and the kind of mobility, the global mobility that we're seeing. And many countries are seeing this as a solution to many issues, particularly care, where you can't automate a lot of it. So rely on people who have other motivation and other drivers to come and work. And we've seen over and over in the UK, especially with Brexit, and other kind of immigration policies that is tightening entry into the care work, that some of these policies have kind of exploited further workers who are driven to come to help, usually help their families back home who have different responsibilities. So they have different priorities, and we kind of, they are accepting certain conditions and certain forms of pay and work that they might not have accepted otherwise, but they have their own pressures back home. They made commitment to send, to remit, and to care, to save for some time. And a study that we just finished looking at the experience of live-in care worker in London that showed that there is quite a high level of exploitation, and particularly with live-in care, where you don't have your own space to live in, so you're completely reliant on the client or the older person that you are supporting on accommodation, in food, and quite a lot of difficult decisions has to be made. So we need to think more about the group of workers who are attracted to these kind of jobs. And in our research also, even you know, British white women who come to this work usually have multiple caring responsibilities. They like the flexibility of work, but it means for them that they have to work so many shifts to just get the decent income that they need to live in. So there are quite a lot of complexities. And with population aging, where you have shrinking working age and you kind of difficulty in automizing care, you're relying on these migration chains, you're relying on the vulnerability of certain groups in the community to make this input. And I think the system is kind of set up to overlook this contribution, so making it more complex to translate this into an economic value.
I mean, I think migration itself is not the problem. It's the low pay and really poor working conditions in the paid care sector that are basically kind of treating the desire to help others as though it's an inexhaustible resource, when in fact people cannot provide good care unless they have some amount of job security and some amount of ability to get to know and engage with the people that they're caring for. And you know, what's happened is that we've designed these really low-wage, low-road jobs where there's really high levels of burnout and turnover. So it's not really good for consumers, for clients either. So our whole system of care provision really needs to be reformed.
Yeah, and just one thing I was thinking about with regard to this recently is, you know, what happens to care workers when they themselves age? And I recently wrote a paper looking at this in the Canadian context, just kind of tracing over time the income and kind of social supports available to women who had migrated through the caregiver program in Canada. And not surprisingly, I think to me or to people listening to this podcast, they have very low incomes when they age. You know, in Canada, they are relying on our old age income support. So even as they're working multiple jobs, as we've noted, they're doing such, you know, essential labor. Over time, they're not set up to, you know, kind of provide for their families or age with dignity. And I think that is, you know, a real social, that's just unconscionable, really, that they're coming and doing this essential labor, and then they themselves are not able to have adequate income when they age or adequate savings. So I think it's often very short-term policies. We're just trying to fill gaps in our labor market, and there isn't like a long-term or system-level thinking in terms of how we're setting these people up to function fairly and equally in society.
Yeah, so in the U.S., undocumented workers are particularly vulnerable because they have absolutely no access to any kind of social benefits or pension benefits or access to health care. So it's a really extreme example of that kind of the disposable worker model.
And I think we can see these kind of trends are similar in different contexts, but also the particularities of context important. And at the center, recently we had a really interesting seminar because the current issue of the International Journal of Care and Caring is all about care in Southern Africa. And one of the papers is about workers from Lesotho who migrated to Southern Africa to work in the mines. And there was lots of discussion about, what happens to these people when they finish working and what kind of provision there is. And also the question of that you kind of brought up there, Naomi, about, I guess, the care cycle and thinking about life course. You know, this is a context where life expectancy is way lower than in North America or Europe. So, which brings us on to thinking a bit more about care. So if we think about, we're talking obviously a lot about valuing care. So the respective approaches that you've all taken in research, can we put a value on care? Or if so, how can we do that? Maybe you can all think about some of the theoretical ideas possibly that you've used to maybe tackle these questions.
Well, one strategy is to look at kind of the output of care, that is to look at indicators of health, mental health and physical health. There's a lot of research on child outcomes, on vulnerability to illness. I mean, we certainly saw during the COVID pandemic a lot of indicators of lives lost as a result of very inadequate care. But I think more generally, it's important to look at the social climate and to see how care is related to really serious social costs like crime, like drug addiction, like alcoholism, what has come to be called in the US deaths of despair, and taking a more ecological approach that is not just individual health outcomes, but what happens to communities when they're deprived of the level of care that they really need to reproduce themselves. And I think there's a lot of interesting new research on that, and a lot of it shows that inequality of access to care is a very, very toxic factor on the community level.
Absolutely, and I think from my point of view, it's really important to think about the policy and the structures and the long term of the sustainability of the kind of outcomes that we want to have. And the idea of, as Nancy said, the met and unmet needs. So we have in the UK, we've just finished a study on unmet needs among older people, and there are huge inequalities related to different groups. And related even to different geography. And if we think of care as a very important component to sustain people's life and high quality life as much as possible with their needs throughout their life course, that would be of great value to the whole society. So I know that there is a huge body of literature trying to make the economic cost between social care and NHS or the healthcare, which usually healthcare is much more expensive, but it's bigger than that, it's broader than that. It's how we function as a society, how we continue living and participating and engaging. And there is huge intergenerational transactions that happen through this. So care is not one way. It's bi-directional, multi-directional. So people who receive care themselves are usually provider of care in other spheres and other contexts. So it's not like there is a deficit of the group who receive care, but a lot of, for example, people living with disabilities would need care, and then they would be very productive socially and economically. And if we talk about older people, the huge input in terms of grandparenting, in terms of financial transaction and housing transaction. So we need to see care in a much broader sense and have a multiplicity of outcomes that sits within the macro level, so the societal level. I think that goes back to Nancy's ecosystem, more ecologically kind of sustained, holistic approach. As long as we're just so fixated about the individual outcome itself, when it comes, say, towards the end of life, then the future returns might not be as high. So you can make some arguments when you talk about childcare, where the future investment and returns to investment can be fruitful. But that kind of type of very limited argument will hinder the whole society, because it will constrain people from thinking about care as a very important element. It's like having parks and having a means of living our lives in a better way and enhancing the quality of life for everybody. So care is a very important component in that structure.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree that taking a more holistic approach and thinking about our entire system of care provisioning, paid and unpaid, marketized and non-marketized, is really essential. But I think when we think about inputs and outputs, it's also about process. And that's where the workers come in, because, we absolutely won't have a system of high quality care provision if we don't value the people that are providing those services. So I think that is where issues like wages, working conditions, access to paid sick days, all the things that were really, I think, highlighted during the pandemic when we saw such a crisis of care really across the globe, those are the issues that are going to set us up for sustainable care provision. So once these become jobs that people not just are motivated to do because they want to help others, but are motivated to stay in over time, that's when we're going to see these long-term improvements in outcomes for clients or recipients of care. So it's all very much interconnected. And I think we need to look at it in that sort of way, just like we need to take more of an intersectional approach when we look at the devaluation of the people receiving care, but also the racialized and migrant women that are providing these services overwhelmingly.
Just to add something, that also the care work itself is changing. So, for example, the work that we're doing in at the Center for Care, we're looking at how policy, macro level, and the kind of direction of, you know, local authorities and the government changing the interface of care work itself. So we're seeing a lot of changes in the roles and the tasks of care workers, the level of skills that they are required to do. The pandemic has actually shifted a lot of work from health to care, where there was lockdowns and restrictions and nurses and healthcare professionals were not able to be in care homes. Actually, care workers started to do that, to learn online and to take these tasks. And now the governments, through their kind of social care workforce policies, are enforcing this through the kind of delegation processes and guidance. And we're seeing this growth in the responsibilities of care workers and the expectations from care workers, but we're not seeing any valuation of that in real world. So it's again, we're relying on the model that they're doing this this semi-quasi vocational work that they're doing because they love doing it. And hence we don't have to put a reward structure, but keep kind of adding to their tasks and adding to their responsibilities. And many of them are willingly taking this because they want to provide better quality of service. So it's kind of the whole structure is set up on that assumption that people will always come to care. There will be always groups coming for whatever reason that they want to do that work and they will take on more. So it's really important to step up and think about the policies and think of how sustainable is that policy in the future. What is the cost? What is the human cost to that? What is the societal cost to that when you create inequalities, further inequalities among this group who's providing that valuable work, but they don't feel valued. So there is a societal cost and the societal problems that Nancy hinted towards earlier in the discussion. So we need to think about that more holistically, but again, try to translate it to economic costs, because without that, you know, many policy makers will not listen to that argument well.
One of the problems that we've run into in the US is the lack of adequate data on care provision, both unpaid and paid. It makes it really hard to do the kind of policy analysis we'd really like to do to make the case. And we just finished, a couple of co-authors and myself just finished a report on measuring care and looking at care data infrastructure. And just to give example of one important finding, there's really no information on care deficits in the US. There's some assessment of food deficits, of people that are going hungry, but there's no systematic source for how many people need childcare but can't get it, how many elder people or people with disabilities need home and community-based services but can't get it. So it's really, really important to develop our data infrastructure in order to be able to look at the policy issues in a more, you know, a more effective way.
Yeah, I'd certainly echo that in the Canadian context too. I think that's true internationally, and it goes back to the fact that this hasn't been a policy priority, but we don't have data, or we don't have enough data. We have, you know, important qualitative studies that, for example, look at language barriers experienced by ethnic minority seniors who need to access home care. You know, I can think of good studies on that in Canada, and I'm sure that's the case in Canada and the UK. But we don't have national level data. We certainly don't have international comparative data to get at that care deficit. And I'd certainly agree that that really hinders our ability to advocate for what is necessary and to kind of create policy changes work to create policy changes at the more macro level.
Yeah, and I guess that is, I mean, this kind of lack of data certainly would fit in with what you're saying, Naomi, about the kind of it being a lack of a policy priority. But I guess it also, which also reflects in the kind of lack of unity in the care workforce and its fragmentation, which is also linked to marketization, outsourcing, a lot of these processes. And it's also related, I suppose, that is a factor in the kind of lack of bargaining power as well that care workers hold. In the UK, we have a devolved system. So in Scotland at the moment, There are moves towards a national care service. We're going to have an election at the UK level next year. The Labour Party currently are quite far ahead in the polls, and they're certainly looking quite closely at having a national care service in Scotland, similar to what we have in healthcare with our National Health Service. So I wonder in North America if there's any kind of there any discussion about moving towards a more kind of unified care workforce, or we talk about professionalisation here. Are there any moves in the North America to think about these things?
Or? Yeah, well, I think about in Canada, really, a current example is that our federal government very recently instituted a national childcare policy. And, you know, I don't want to take away from this. This is a huge victory for women, for society as a whole. I recently became a mother. This is something that's like immediately relevant to me. But it goes back to some of the challenges we're seeing is that there aren't enough workers to fill the new places that have been provided in childcare centers. And this is especially true in kind of more rural or remote or less central areas. So I know I sound like I'm beating a dead horse, but I think it goes back to this idea that they have to be well-paid jobs that people are motivated to do. And if we don't have enough childcare providers, it really doesn't matter, or enough people that want to do that job, that stay in that job, high levels of turnover, high levels of burnout that are related to poor working conditions, then, you know, it's really at the level of rhetoric. So that's one thing I'd say. Just the other point I wanted to make is that, yeah, bargaining power, very important. And I think we've all hinted at this, but it's very hard for especially home care workers to organize. A lot of people working in the care economy are, you know, working at isolated workplaces, you know, not large places where, you know, organizing is easier, like a hospital or even a long-term care home, where there are certainly higher rates of unionization. And also just that these are people that are often working shift work, working multiple jobs, and it just makes it that much more challenging to kind of have a large organized strategy. But I think it's something that still unions and kind of advocates need to be working towards.
So in the US, the Democratic Party has really moved towards a very strong care agenda. And they outlined legislation last fall as part of what was called the Build Back Better Act that was really, really pretty, very promising, with attention to raising wages of low-paid care workers, increasing the supply of child care and home and community-based services. It lost by one vote, basically, in the Senate. So it's very contested, and I think it really helps us understand that care provision is really a site of very complicated distributional conflict. We live in a world where there are a lot of different forms of collective conflict going on between workers and employers, between citizens of affluent countries and citizens of poor countries. There's also a distributional struggle over people who are providing care and people who are getting it basically for free. So I think it kind of, just thinking about these issues kind of can maybe help us understand why we live in such a complicated political environment.
Yeah, and I think this lack of voice and fragmentation of care workers pose a lot of challenges when we do research on the value of care. So although that there are steps that have been taken in the UK, for example, we have a care register in Wales and in Northern Ireland and in Scotland, we don't have one in England, which has the largest number of care workers. And just not having a register of people working in care in itself, it makes it very difficult to understand who's doing what where. And increasingly, and it goes with, so there are a lot of good reasons why we're having diversity in the care provision, because we want to allow people to have choice and control and decide the type and nature of work, and policies like personalization and personal budget, which is cash for care, allows people to choose from a market, but it also increases the fragmentation of that market. So it's very difficult to understand fully the landscape. We can make assumptions, but there is a lot of missing gaps and data unfortunately is not great. So we have some data in England, primarily collected from employers. So we lose a lot of the voices of the most kind people who are the most peculiar working conditions, who are kind of self-employed or casually employed or doing different things like personal assistant. So this, again, we need, of course, we need better data, but we need better sources of data. And we need to take, maybe even when we do research, we incorporate qualitative and quantitative approach more formally through different techniques. So recently, I was just speaking in one of the seminars for the Center of Care of using Bayesian methodology to include some quantitative, to use quantitative big data set, but also to use qualitative, research to add in indicators so we can have more holistic picture. So as researchers, we want to make better use of all the information and resources that we have and data sources, and not kind of say, oh, we only need some quantitative data, because sometimes you don't have that. You have a good qualitative studies. Use these as indicators to help you kind of draw a picture, a broader picture of care workers, what they do, how we can value their work that happens in different spheres, that happened in different structures, and are paid differently in different ways. So exactly the complex nature of the provision of care will translate itself when we come to do research on the value of care.
Yes, well, I guess that a lot of what we've been pointing to and thinking about and through is the value of care, but we're thinking also about the fact that the value of care is more than an economic thing. It's more than a fiscal thing in nature. So I wonder if anyone wants to maybe come in there and speak to that that point in a broader sense, moving beyond thinking about quantifying care and thinking about just as a form of research. I wonder if anyone wants to come in on that point.
Well, I'll come in because I think economics really has to change. I think what has come to be called an economic approach is basically a kind of the money metric and gross domestic product. And really what economics should be about is the production and the development and the maintenance of human capabilities that have intrinsic value, not reducible to dollars. And thinking about, you know, what's the relationship between how we're organizing, how we're spending our time and our money, and what's happening to our collective capabilities is just a better way of thinking about the economy. And in fact, there's a lot of interest now in on the macroeconomic level and on the national policy level about thinking about the quote-unquote well-being economy and just changing the scoreboard. Instead of measuring success in terms of gross domestic product, to think of a dashboard of indicators that we would want to use in which mental and physical and community health would be first and foremost.
Yeah, I think there is a growing recognition of the importance of focusing on inequalities. Inequalities among care provision, inequalities among care recipients. And, you know, if we go back to this holistic idea, then that's thinking about the ways that gender and migration and race play out specifically within our care economy. And, you know, how we think about this going forward, maybe it's through legislation, maybe it's through increased social supports, maybe it's through, you know, greater universalization and the provision of health and education and social services. But I think we need to recognize that, you know, as long as these care chains are so fundamental to our care economy, we have a responsibility as countries that are receiving care providers to think about not just them as filling gaps in our labor market, but to think about them as human beings and think about the ways we can help them to have, you know, permanent resettlement in countries, bring their family members over, do the jobs that they were trained to do, you know, so that if they were nurses in their home countries, they're able to be nurses at least relatively quickly when they come here, and so that they can come with their families, you know, not be separated for decades, so that they have maternity leave and you know, sick leave and fair wages. And, you know, I did research on personal support workers who were working in long-term care homes right when the pandemic hit. And I think the pandemic was kind of like a magnifying glass. It just made everything, all these existing inequalities, worse. And this was, I mostly do quantitative research, but to speak to what Shereen said, I think that we did qualitative work because there was no quantitative data at that point. And it was so important to hear from these women's voices themselves. And they were saying their wages were 50 to 70% reduced during the pandemic. And these are already low wage workers. So we need to kind of prioritize, I think, creating or reducing inequalities in our labor market and in our kind of social policy systems if we want to improve our care economy going forward.
Sorry, Naomi, can I just come in there and just ask why were the wages so reduced so heavily at that point?
Absolutely. So we're talking, this was within long-term care homes. And what happened was that there were single site work policies across Canada, I think also in the UK and the US, meaning they could only work in one long-term care home. And that makes perfect sense from a public health perspective. And the women I spoke to absolutely understood that. But the truth is they had been working at multiple job sites. And why was that? Because employers were reluctant to give them permanent full-time jobs because then they have to pay them benefits. So, you know, when the pandemic hit, all of a sudden they could only work three quarters of a job when before they'd been working one and a half jobs. And so, yeah, that meant that in addition to kind of doing this work where they were very scared about their own well-being, their health, their family's health, they also were then unable to, you know, pay their mortgage or their car payments, let alone send money back to their families, which is something that, you know, most of them had been doing on a very sustained basis. So that was just really striking to me in terms of how when things get really tough, it's the most vulnerable workers that are hit the hardest.
And very similar results we found from in England. So we did two studies, one looking at the single site policies and the different policies that were introduced during the pandemic. It was a comparative study and we had Canada and the States on that. But in England, there were similar issues to do with lockdowns within particularly care homes where people who used to, and we talked about that earlier, to maintain a decent living, they have to work in multiple sites, they have to work in multiple jobs. But when the pandemic hit, and with some of these restrictions, they were not able to work in multiple sites. So they have to only reduce their hours. But more than that, so we had another study, a big, large survey, around 1,800 responded. With high sick leave and high infection rates, people had to do more hours unpaid. So if you're already running at a low capacity and there is a high vacancy rate, people who remain on site when others fell sick, they are doing more hours and unpaid hours. So there was a huge inequalities, huge level of exploitation. And our study showed something very hard, that there was high level of abuse as well. So the image of care workers in the UK were terrible because they were thinking people who go to homes to do home care basically are infection spreader. And there was huge public abuse. So coming from the public, care workers working in residential care and have to apply restriction around family visitation were seen as the bad guys who are preventing family coming to see their loved ones. And hence, they have been facing a lot of abuse because people are frustrated and getting that frustration on them. So on top of working more hours and having less pay, they were actually facing huge level of abuse. So 25% of our sample said that they received abuse, and that figure increased to nearly 50% among people from ethnic minorities. So that shows you again that there is a vulnerabilities and hierarchies within vulnerabilities. So really that is really need to look at that. But at the same time, we're seeing policy pushing forward for care workers to do more tasks, to do more work without acknowledging them. So coming back to the question around kind of you know, moving forward and thinking about what needs to be done. And it really, you know, building on the issues of migration, the issues of realizing the value of care more than just dollars and more than just the immediate return. There are different returns. It's think to have a global perspective as well, because this is a mobile world. We know that a lot of countries in Europe and North America will continue to have shrinking working age, and they will continue to need and require people who do that work. A lot of them are migrants, but think about that as a global perspective, because other countries as well are aging. So we need to think about the whole care in a very, you know, kind of a holistic, but more than national, it's very global. And there is a lot of, you know, transactions, international transactions are happening, and care transactions. So people care abroad, care at a distance, provide care virtually, or provide care in two places. So we need to have a holistic national view, but also a more global view, having a bit of foresight to the future that we are all going through needing more care because we're all living longer, but unfortunately we're not living healthier all the time. There will be need for care during our late lives. So thinking about that more globally, more holistically across national borders. So believing care will help us all to age together better, to move to a better future, to have, you know, better futures for our children, but for ourselves. We can work longer, we can relearn and re-enter to economies, different economies, and have this social productivity in our societies.
I would just add one thing, which is that we've really focused on, and with good reason, focused on low-wage workers in most of what we've been saying. But it's also true that the care workforce includes a lot of relatively well-educated and well-paid workers that we think of as being pretty middle-class, nurses and teachers. And our research in the U.S. shows that these workers are paying a big penalty relative to what workers with similar education and experience are earning. And in fact, we also found, somewhat to our surprise, that even managers and professionals in health and education and social services were being paid far less than managers and professionals in business services. And this comes back to the point about the difficulty of kind of monetizing or capturing the value of care that's provided. And I think it also creates the potential to create some kind of cross-class, cross-race alliances around the importance of really valuing care.
Yeah, we haven't really touched upon the question of gender or class so much, but I think Naomi's point about thinking intersectionally about this would incorporate that. I wonder if maybe you could just say a little bit more about that intersectional approach. Possibly some of our listeners might not be so familiar with that.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, first, I think in terms of what Nancy just said about that devaluation within the industry of care, even at different levels of occupational professionalization, the main lens we see with that is gender, right? These are overwhelmingly feminized, feminized industries. So, again, jobs that women do pay less, we know this, and jobs that women do are disproportionately jobs within the caring industry. So I think that this gender lens is very much relevant, yeah, all the way from doctors to, you know, early childhood, you know, care assistants.
And also relevant to all women who are mothers, because we know on top of penalties in paid care work that women pay a huge penalty in lifetime earnings from creating the next generation. Yeah. You know, the work on which our kind of future as a society depends, the costs and benefits of that work are very unequally distributed and really contribute to the feminization of poverty.
And caring for parents and people with disabilities. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think gender is really glaring. Any way we look at this care deficit or this devaluation, and I think in terms of a more intersectional lens. It's, you know, it is the kind of transference of care responsibilities from kind of upper class women to who, you know, are overwhelmingly entering the workforce or have entered the workforce for decades now. But their ability to do so is, you know, oftentimes on the backs of lower class women who are overwhelmingly racialized or migrant women. And this is kind of how we've set up this kind of gender equality in the labor market, is such that there is this real intersectional disadvantage, and such that it's only possible for upper class women to get these great jobs and kind of do it all, in quotations, because, you know, more vulnerable women are doing the kind of backroom dirty jobs, or raising children, or caring for elderly people or people with disabilities. So I think it's really incumbent on us to think intersectionally when we're trying to look forward in terms of making improvements to how we value care, how we provide care, how we think about care.
And I think Nancy kind of mentioned, touched upon the future of the planet. And I think you were maybe hinting at the importance of thinking about taking an intersectional approach, thinking about care in holistic terms, in terms of our future and the climate's future. So maybe we can finish by, Nancy, maybe you could make a point there about connecting these discussions with the climate. We haven't talked about that, but maybe you could round things off.
Well, first of all, I mean, I think there is kind of a wave of interest, of concern, of urgency about the social climate as well as the physical climate. And we can learn so much from a comparison. You know, just think how long it took us to figure out that our climate is changing, and to persuade people, not everyone, but many people, that the causes of that are really rooted in the way we've organized our economic system. And you know, we're in a similar situation. It's very hard to understand climate, what's happening to climate. It's hard to understand the social climate. We're just in the middle of figuring that out, really, how inequality and how unmet need and how collective conflict impose social costs. So I don't think we have a magic solution, but we do have, I think, a lot of motivation to think more creatively about a more sustainable an equitable economic system, and really realizing that those two things have to go together.
Thank you very much. I think that's a good way to end, and for us to think moving forward to embrace those challenges. So all that remains for me to do now is to thank our guests. Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
And to thank you for listening. Thank you.